Hello, and welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. I'm Raquel Williams. We're joined today by Dr. Brian Salata. He is a cardiology specialist with a focus on cardiovascular imaging at Hackensack Meridian Health JFK Medical Center. Welcome to the program, Dr. Salata.
Well, thank you, Raquel. That's very kind of you.
Let's start off by talking about the different types of cardiovascular issues that we have. And perhaps we can just get right into a heart attack, because I think when people hear about heart issues, the first thing they think about is, okay, well, the first is heart attack. What are some of the signs and warnings that someone may be having or could soon have a heart attack?
Yeah, so, you know, the classic symptoms that people have or that they think about when you think about a heart attack is this chest pressure that comes on with exertion or with some sort of emotional stressor that can happen suddenly or can be happening when you're jogging. And often they think of the radiation of the chest pressure down the arm. The classic kind of words that people use is the elephant sitting on the chest. And while this is kind of the stereotypical symptoms of a heart attack, they can be a little bit more subtle. You can sometimes feel palpitations or just feeling that your heart is beating very fast. You can feel a little lightheaded, dizzy. You can sometimes feel some nausea or vomiting. Classically, women tend to have the less common symptoms, and men tend to gear more towards the typical symptoms of the elephant sitting on the chest. The one thing that I like to tell patients is that if the symptoms are brought on with exertion, or if you notice them with emotional stress, that leans towards it being more of the classic what we call angina symptoms that are suggestive of heart disease. And sometimes it's difficult to differentiate if it's heart disease or if it's anxiety or if it's chest pain from, you know, from a pneumonia or rib pain. And that's why we like to see the patients to assess them, do an EKG, and maybe do an echo and an ultra and some sort of stress test to differentiate them. Of course, if it's a severe symptoms that come on suddenly, it's something that emergently needs to be seen in the hospital, and we need to act on pretty aggressively at that point.
I'm glad you mentioned that heart attack symptoms and signs present differently, and many times they present differently in women than they do men. And I'm wondering if the medical community is starting to, you know, realize this and are treating women accordingly. Not so much that, you know, oh, it could be stress or, oh, it just might be, you know, this. Perhaps you just need to make a change, but perhaps there's actually a problem that we need to look into, given that, you know, these symptoms are a little bit different, but common for women.
No, Raquel, that's an excellent point. Classically, the research that was done back in the 70s, 80s, 90s looked primarily at men, or at least the cohorts included men at a much larger percentage than women. And so we saw the symptoms as being something, or the presentation as something that was classically seen in men. And with women, you have to be a little bit more, even men, you still need to be a little bit more aware that, you know, these symptoms aren't your classic symptoms, but you still need to be cognizant of what might be going on with our patients. And that the atypical presentation could still be a real presentation we have to be aggressive for, which is why we do the workup with the men and women at that point, particularly if they have risk factors, high blood pressure, diabetes, older age.
Okay. What are some of the more common types of cardiovascular disease?
Yeah, so I mean, I would, of course, as you were saying, the heart attack is what we call coronary artery disease, and it's probably the most prevalent given the risk factors and the presentation that we've seen of patients, and that can lead to, after you have a heart attack, you can have something that's called heart failure, where the heart muscle itself either isn't squeezing as well, or there's a lack of filling of the left side of the heart following the heart attack. And that is something that can happen after a heart attack, can happen in the setting of just having long-standing high blood pressure or in other disease processes where there's actual the muscles infiltrated by other materials or chemicals at that point. And so we heart failure is something that we chronically see, and given the longstanding nature of it, patients may require advanced care following heart disease. Another basket of issues that we see is rhythm issues. So one term you may have heard before is atrial fibrillation. It is something that happens, again, in the setting of people with high blood pressure, with other risk factors that can lead to an increased risk of atrial fibrillation over time. And with atrial fibrillation, living in atrial fibrillation typically isn't by itself something that's severe, but there's an increased risk of stroke with the atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
And if someone has heart failure, they can often be more symptomatic in the setting of having atrial fibrillation. So we have to monitor it closely, mm-hmm. and we work with the specialist, the electrophysiologist, who can actually help to manage the atrial fibrillation. There are a multitude of other rhythm issues, including ventricular tachycardias and ventricular rhythms that we deal with, and then other atrial rhythms that we deal with. But the main baskets of categories for heart disease would be the ischemic or heart attack diseases, the heart failure category of disease, and then the rhythm arrhythmias that we deal with.
Okay, so atrial fibrillation, is that the same thing as someone having an irregular heartbeat?
It's one of the possibilities in terms of having an irregular heartbeat. It is the most common irregular heartbeat that we see in the hospital, mm-hmm. And that we work with in the hospital at this point, and also in the clinic. And management of it has changed over the years in terms of whether we just treat it with medications and try to keep the heart rate in a nice range, or whether to be more aggressive to get them back into the normal rhythm, which is what we call sinus rhythm. Things are gearing towards being a little bit more aggressive to move them back towards sinus rhythm, just in terms of functional status. But many times we'll allow patients to be, if they're in a nice range and they're asymptomatic, we allow them to be in atrial fibrillation as long as the heart rate stays in control.
Earlier you mentioned a stress test. What exactly is a stress test, and what happens during that time?
Yeah, so there's multiple forms of stress tests. And depending on someone's risk for heart disease, based on the risk factors and their presentation, we will decide which type of stress test to do, because there are some of the stress tests do include a radioactive, a small amount of a radioactive material. So we save that for patients that we truly think may have cardiovascular disease. Other ones are more time intensive, and so we also save that for people we think are at higher risk. Individuals that are at lower risk, we tend to do the exercise stress test. That I think when people think of a classic stress test, they think of themselves on a treadmill, and you mm-hmm. walk for a little bit, and then you tend to run after that up to a certain speed. We watch the EKG, and we see if there are changes on it that are suggestive of a reduced blood flow to the heart that make us think that are you at risk for having a heart attack at that point. Other ones we can do with an ultrasound to see if there's any changes to the muscle tissue of the heart. So if you think of the heart as a muscular football, it squeezes each time your heart beats. And if we see a certain part of it doesn't squeeze after you've ran a certain distance and your heart rate got to a certain rate, then we know that at that point there's a suggestion that there's some lack of blood flow to that part of the heart, that wall of the heart.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the risk factors for coronary artery disease specifically, and we'll take them one by one because these are all very important things. And I'm assuming that by and large, coronary artery disease sometimes is something that can be prevented, especially when it comes to lifestyle. Hypertension is one of the risk factors, from what I understand. And it depends on the person. Sometimes that could be hereditary, but sometimes that's something that can be under control. Talk to me about hypertension and how it can affect the heart.
Yeah, so I mean, the risk for, in general, lifestyle risk factors can be up to 80% of something that we can control that can reduce someone's risk for coronary artery disease. Hypertension itself is anywhere between 20 to 25% of the lifestyle risk factors. So it really is something that we, if we're aggressive about and we get it around between 120 and 130 for people at highest risk, 130 to 140 with less risk, we can really improve their long-term risk for coronary disease. It's very difficult to get individuals to understand that importance when we see them in the hospital, because they're like, well, my blood pressure is always 140s and 150s, and they may be 30 to 40 years old. And at that age, it's not an issue. For me, my blood pressure, it's 130, sometimes it gets close to 140. And I'm like, well, it's not that big of an issue. But when you think about your blood vessels over and your heart over that long-term 20 to 30 years of having a higher blood pressure, our goal as both primary care and as cardiology is to teach individuals that long-standing higher blood pressure is what causes these acute events to happen. And so we need to educate individuals that it's important to get their blood pressure under control. And it doesn't start with medications. It starts with a low-salt diet that's obviously high in vegetables and fruits. That can get your blood pressure down about 8 to 9 points right there, just with eating a healthy diet. And so that's the first thing that we can try with patients when we see them in the clinic and they have a slightly elevated high blood pressure. There are some individuals that are more sensitive based on the stress in their life. So getting them ways to reduce the stress in their life, while very difficult in 2021, is something that's very important as well.
Yeah, we somehow have to figure that out, because I don't see the stresses going away anytime soon, doctor. So they changed the guidance from 120 over 80 to something else. There was some change made a few years ago. What is the new guidance and why did they make that change?
So I think the guidance was based on, so it's a risk benefit comparison that the national guidelines have looked at. And they saw that by trying to get people to a very low blood pressure, there was actually a higher risk of people getting severely low with a goal to under 120 over 80. And that the benefit of it in terms of reduction of cardiovascular events and for stroke and heart attacks was not as beneficial as the risk was. So that they limited they reduced the strictness of our guidelines now. And so really for individuals that don't have diabetes or renal disease, the goal is now actually under 140 over 80 at this point. And then individuals who already have some form of disease, diabetes and kidney disease and heart attack and stroke, it's 130 over 80 at this point. And they obviously talk first about, the importance of lifestyle and then of adding medications onto it after that.
You mentioned diet, and that's one of the lifestyle issues that can contribute to coronary artery disease, and something that is something that we can control if we try to. For hypertension, you mentioned a low salt diet, and all I'm thinking about is all the fast food that's out there and the way we've been eating, especially while we've been under the stress over the past year and a half to 2 years. We're not really taking care of ourselves as best that we could. Eating, some of us do the comfort eating, like I do.
You reach for
the salty, the things that make you feel good. The feel good comfort foods are not really good for you. But diet is something that definitely contributes to that. And we have a horrible diet overall, don't we?
Well, I think as a nation, we are used to, and I think we were over maybe 50, 60 years, it's been the way that we've developed our food in the grocery stores is that it does have high calories, it has high salt content. We thought carbs were healthy and that fats were bad. I'm not saying all fats are good, but there are certain fats that are good. But I think we're starting to learn that there are certain types of carbohydrates out there that are a little bit more deleterious. I think we're starting to learn how much salt does play a factor in a lot of these diseases. And I guess I'm someone, I unfortunately don't cook a lot. I could never be a good cook, and I use a lot of microwavable meals, but I make sure to find ones that when I look on the back, salt is created by sodium. It's part of it is sodium. So just look for the lowest salt content in your microwavable meals, or when you're eating fries, not saying you should eat them a lot, but mm-hmm. if you're going to have them once a week, try once just not to add the salt on top. The little changes to your diet over time is what can really improve your health, especially for younger individuals who don't yet have diseases accumulated. It's important to try to build these lifestyle changes earlier so that the progression of it doesn't build up over time.
Now, as far as cholesterol is concerned, what is a safe number, if there is a safe number for cholesterol levels, and what's a good way to control that?
So the main cholesterol that we talk about, there's different types of cholesterol, but the main ones mm-hmm. that we look at are the LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, right. and the HDL, which is the good cholesterol. The recommendations are for individuals to have an LDL, if they don't have a previous coronary disease or stroke, to have the LDL under 130. My goal is to say, you want it close to 100, between 100 and 130, aiming towards the 100 area. And then once you have some form of cardiovascular disease, you want your goal to be closer to 70. Again, it's the same mantra in terms of what makes your LDL lower is eating lean meats. That's like your chicken and your fish, and eating high vegetables and a lot of fruit in your diet. And then in terms of the HDL, which is your good cholesterol, the fish is what's really been shown. Exercise has been shown to improve your HDL. And then there's back and forth in terms of like one glass of red wine a day that may improve your HDL. That mild consumption of alcohol may improve your HDL, but it doesn't mean overconsumption of alcohol at this point.
What about smoking? And it's interesting because I don't see the amount of smoking that we saw, say, 15 years ago. Smoking isn't what it used to be. And, with all the campaigns over the past couple of decades, anti-smoking, all butts out, that type of thing. But there are still smokers. People do still smoke. And talk about how that affects heart health.
Yeah, I mean, it's close. The research I was looking into, it's close to the effects of hypertension, maybe not quite as strong in terms of the risk factors, but close to 20% of the risk for a cardiac event is attributable to smoking if someone is a cigarette smoker. And it's not just the direct effects of the smoke, it's the inflammation it causes on the body and on the blood vessels that leads to the long-term damage. And I can't speak to how difficult it is to quit smoking, mm-hmm. but even a reduction in the amount of cigarettes someone smokes can improve it. And, it's something that we work with our patients who struggle with to make sure that we can help them reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease if we can help them to stop smoking.
Okay. And diabetes, of course, is yet another risk factor for coronary artery disease. And in some cases, it's something that can be controlled. And other cases, it's something that was brought on not by the patient's behavior or lifestyle.
And that that's a lot of times it's patients who are much younger who have diabetes who then have not just the cardiovascular disease but also the renal disease. And this is one again, like hypertension, it's something that the high sugars and the dysregulation within the body is not quite apparent at a young age, but we try to teach patients that over time it affects the blood vessels, it affects your kidneys, your nerve endings in your feet and your hands and in your eyes, it affects your heart. And so we want to teach them that we as a team, it's not just about them, but we as a team need to be very aggressive in terms of managing their blood sugars, and that they're not alone in this avenue to figure out how to manage their diabetes, but that together we can hopefully keep their sugars in a healthy range and find a way for them to live as close to their normal lifestyle as possible while taking the medications required for diabetes management.
Well, Dr. Salata, you are a cardiology specialist and you have a focus on cardiovascular imaging. And I can imagine that at Hackensack Meridian Health, the JFK Medical Center, you're using some of the top equipment as far as technology and advancements in diagnosis.
Yeah. So, you know, the primary mode of diagnosing cardiovascular disease that we do here is using the nuclear scans. And so what for patients or for other individuals to know, what that entails is you either are exercising or we give you a medication that dilates the heart, and we're able to then use a radio tracer that's injected into the arm and then goes towards the heart, and it stays in the heart. And if there's a lack of blood flow to a territory after you've exercised, then we're able to see that lack of blood flow after about 45 minutes. It's a very rapid test that happens within 4 to 5 hours. We're able to figure out exactly what area of the heart may be damaged. And the part of this modality is that compared to other scanning modalities, whether it's the echocardiography that we also do, or it is the CT scan. This is a very sensitive modality, and it helps us not just in patients who are inpatient or outpatient, but even in patients who come into the emergency room and are just there for 24 hours or less than that. We're able to figure out, is this related to a possible heart disease, or is this a non-cardiac picture that's going on?
Let's talk about some of those lifestyle modifications that can be made, the ones that we can change and reduce our risks. What are some lifestyle modifications that women and men can make after they've been diagnosed with heart disease? What should they be doing?
Yeah, so I mean, we mentioned on some of them before, the smoking is something that we try to work on. We are very aggressive in terms of diabetes management and cholesterol management. There's we will make sure that they're on certain medications that help with the cholesterol, and then they will follow up with us in clinic to reassess all of their diabetes. There's actually a rehab center that we that post myocardial infarction or post heart attack patients actually go to that allows them to get back to their functional status, and then from there work on rehabilitation and strengthening themselves to make sure that they are improving their physical activity or their lifestyle at that point. We, you know, can work in terms of dietary assessment to ensure that they are following through with that. And then as the cardiologist, my primary goal is to make sure that they're taking the correct medications. There's a multitude of medications that are possibly given after a heart attack, and some patients leave with 3 or 4 medications. And my goal is to know that, you know, there's up to 40% of patients after being given 4 medications, they won't be taking those medications. They won't be taking at least one of those medications after they leave the hospital. My goal is to educate them on the importance of each one and what each one does and why we want to include them. And if there's a reason they can't take one, whether it's a side effect from a medication or whether it's a cost issue, that we figure out if it's a side effect that we switch to an agent that doesn't have that side effect, or if it's a cost issue that we find a way to either work through that cost issue or we switch to another medication that fits within their budget and is covered by their insurance.
Okay, doctor, in our final moment, what is it that you would like or that you tend to say to all your patients when they come in? What's the one common thing that you would recommend to all people who are concerned about, want to make sure that they stay out of these waters when it comes to heart health?
I would say that I tell them, ask me absolutely any question, because I don't want them to go home and have questions that are unanswered and not know, understand something if it's important to them. If they have the slightest symptom of something and they think, oh, that's not a big deal, and maybe it is something we have to follow up, or maybe they don't understand that this medication should be taken twice a day, and I didn't explain that, you know, when I said twice a day, I said it too quickly for them. I want them to have all of their questions answered, and ensure that we have an open communication in that sense, and that they can always feel free to call the clinic, and I can call them back with any of their questions they have. I think that's the most important thing, is that I want it to be an open dialogue between me and the patient.
Right. I'm glad you said that, because the communication between doctor and patient is extremely important. Don't guess. Ask.
Right.
Great advice. Right. We have been with Dr. Brian Salata. He is with Hackensack Meridian Health JFK University Medical Center, a cardiology specialist with a focus on cardiovascular imaging. Doctor, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you for your time.